organizers for inviting me here. It's always a pleasure to come to Perimeter. And this conference is very interesting. I liked the introduction of Lucien, who promises to have a very creative environment, probably also in the discussions. So my talk is about infinite composite systems and cellular automata in operational probabilistic theories. And I will review in this talk some results that are related to a project we are working on in Pavia. And this project is related to the fact that after the experience of quantum information theory, we understand quantum mechanics in a different way, and we understand quantum theory as an information processing theory. This is something that we, most of the audience here, I think, shares as in common. And the structure of the theory, understanding the structure of the theory as an information theory, doesn't cover the whole of quantum mechanics, because now we understand how systems compose, we understand the way in which the information contained in quantum systems can be processed, and the properties of these compositional rules that make quantum theory special. But we don't have in this picture the mechanical part of the theory. We don't have space and time. They are not informational primitives. And we don't have energy, momentum, and all these kind of classical things that were introduced in the quantum mechanics by quantizing the classical counterparts. So the idea of the project is to push the informational approach a step further and try to re-encompass all the mechanical concepts into quantum mechanics, starting from a purely informational background. And I like at this point to quote Feynman, who was one of the fathers of quantum computation, that actually devised quantum computers exactly for a purpose which is very close to the one that I described now. And the idea of Feynman was to have a computer that exactly simulates physical laws. And when he says exactly, it doesn't mean like in everyday computation where we do routines to simulate differential equations with some approximation in terms of finite difference equations. But he has in mind a precise model of physical laws. So this idea introduces the concept of physical laws as algorithms. So a physical law can be thought of as a rule that updates the content of some memory cells in a computer. And understanding physical laws in this way requires us to go a step beyond the present understanding of operational probabilistic theories and to say something more about processes that will describe a physical law. So instead of considering any process in operational probabilistic theory, we would like to understand what processes correspond, for example, to the evolution of a free electron or an electron subject to an electromagnetic field and something like that. And maybe one day also to gravitational effects. So the candidate for this purpose is a cellular automaton that I will discuss in a few minutes. And in order to introduce these concepts in a very general scenario of operational probabilistic theories, I need to do some steps, to take some steps. And so let's start with a very brief recap of what is an operational probabilistic theory. This is the formulation that we gave in our papers, but of course there are lots of other authors that deal with the so-called generalized probabilistic theories, which are very similar to what I'm describing here. Anyway, in our picture, the basic notion is that of a test. So a test is some collection of events that occur when you do some operation on a system, when some information processing, even some process occurs, physical process occurs on a system, like an information processing task. And this collection of event is labeled by some index and as an input wire and an output wire, which represent the systems that are processed in this test. And then there are very simple compositional rules where these wires are labeled, and they can be connected in a sequence only if the labels coincide. So you can construct very complicated circuits like that. And you see from the picture here that you also have a rule to compose systems in parallel. So you to take two systems, put them together, and get a composite system, like an atom, an hydrogen atom, which is the composition of an electron and a proton. And all these rules define the operational language. The most important thing that I would like to stress about these rules for composing processes is this commutation relation, which is composing two processes in parallel and then other two in parallel, and then taking the sequence of these two, the sequential composition of these two, is the same as composing the two upper ones in a sequence, composing two lower ones in a sequence, and then composing them in parallel. So this is the most important rule in the scenario of operational probabilistic theories. As a consequence of this, if you do a local test in a system and an independent local test in another system, these two commute. You can do this one later or earlier, and you will obtain the same process. Okay. So for now, I described some rules for composing processes. So this is just a descriptive language, a way in which we can describe processes occurring on your systems. But there's no predictive power to this theory. So that's why we introduce also probabilities. And the probabilities come in this way. Every time we have a process that involves a trivial system, a system which has essentially one state, this process corresponds to a probability distribution. So, for example, if you have a circuit like this with a transformation that takes the trivial system into a non-trivial one, and then another test that destroys the system and takes it into a trivial one, then this can be interpreted as a preparation and a measurement. And the probability associated with the circuit is the joint probability of preparing the ith state and measuring the jth effect. So this way of imposing the probabilistic structure on the operational theory gives a natural structure to the set of states and effects of the theory. So the measurements are described by essentially functionals on states, and states is functional effects. So you can very naturally take linear combinations of them, and then you construct real vector spaces, which are the state space and the effect space. So you have a cone of physical effects, a cone of physical states, and these two cones lie within vector spaces, real vector spaces, which are the span of states and the span of effects as functionals on each other. So transformations, which are the most general case of tests, are linear maps on top of these spaces. Okay? This is a simple picture, after all. And the most important kind of theories we are interested in is the case of causal theories. And from now on, I will restrict my attention to this case. Causal theories can be introduced in many ways. The way I will do it here is to say that it's possible to do any arbitrary conditional test. So any conditional test that you want is possible within the theory. What is a conditional test? It's a test where you do a measurement here, and depending on the outcome, you do in a sequence an operation that depends on the outcome. So you use the information that you have here to do the process, the subsequent processing. Okay. One can prove that this condition implies the fact that there's a unique deterministic effect, so maybe the most popular version of the causality constraint that most of you already know. So in a sense, this condition is the no signaling from the future. This means that suppose that you have a test like that, so a preparation and a measurement, and you know that the source prepares some states which are labeled, so you know what state was prepared by the source, even though you cannot predict it deterministically. And then you do a measurement, and you have this joint probability. So now if you forget about the outcome of the measurement, so you wash away the information that you have from the measurement, then you get a probability distribution on the outcomes of the state preparation that in general depends on the measurement that you did. Okay. So if this probability depends on the measurement that you did, it's clear that someone who controls the source, just reading the label, has some information about what measurement was done in the future on the system. So causality forbids this fact, communicating to a source just changing the measurement apparatus. And indeed, the uniqueness of a deterministic effect implies that this probability distribution does not depend on the choice of measurement. So this is an important property that I will assume from now on. So now let's go to the notion of a cellular automaton. And this is the classical notion, the cellular automata that were introduced by von Neumann in a series of lectures that was published after his death in 1966 by Birks, who took the lecture notes. And this is the notion of a cellular automaton that is present in the literature since then. It's based on the notion of an array of memory cells. This is a classical cellular automaton, so these cells are contain, for example, bits, classical bits. And then a rule that updates the content of every cell, but just looking at some neighborhood of the cell. So for example, if you want to know what is the updated content of this cell after a computational step by the cellular automaton, you have to look at this neighborhood, control the content of the cells, bits, and calculate the function of these three bits, and then write down the bit at the next step. So, for example, Conway's Game of Life is a cellular automaton, and it's interesting because it has some patterns like this one that after a while just stop and freeze and become stationary. Other patterns that become oscillating, so start oscillating after a given time, and other ones that are not periodic and just keep moving forever. So very simple rules that give rise to a variety of behaviors, of interesting behaviors that can be can give us an idea that these things, even though they're very simple update rules, can make sense of the physical reality that we have around us. So how do we use cellular automata in our framework to describe physical law? So what we did by now was to consider fermionic cellular automata that can be thought of as an array made of a bunch of fermionic modes. So essentially, if you don't know what is fermionic quantum computation, you can think of a bunch of qubits with a super selection rule. So you cannot take superpositions of states with an even number of ones and an odd number of ones. And then there's another slight difference, which is that operations that are done locally on the qubits do not correspond to local operations on the fermions, and vice versa. There's a mapping between the operators describing transformations on qubits and fermions, and the other way around. But apart from this, it's a rather simple theory. And so we take a set of fermionic modes, possibly a countable one. And on top of this, we impose an evolution rule that updates the content of the cells of this cellular automaton, which means updates the state of the cells. And the rule is described in terms of what happens to the field operators that describe the algebra of observables of these fermionic modes. So typically, the fermionic modes come with an algebra of field operators that obey the anti-commutation rules, the canonical anti-commutation rules. And the evolution is given by a rule that tells you what is the field operator describing the field at a given site at step t plus one in terms of the field operators at the previous step, the field operators of other cells. So in particular, the case of linear fermionic cellular automata is the case where this new field operator is just a linear combination of the field operators at the previous step. So for example, if this is the case, you can just look at the matrices of coefficients for these linear combinations, and every time you find a non-null coefficient, you will draw an arrow between the two sites that are connected by this information flow. So this means that the field content at this site at a given step of the computation depends on the content of this cell at the previous step of the computation. So this is a graph. This is an arrow that describes some causal influence of one site on the other, according to the evolution rule. So you can construct a full graph out of these influence relations. And so you see that from this completely unstructured bunch of memory cells, you see a geometry that is coming out. And this is dictated just by the way in which the information content of the cells evolves according to the evolution rule. So the physical law determines also the connection, the causal connections between the cells, the sites containing the cells of the memory. In particular, we could focus attention on the case of homogeneous cellular automata. You can think of them, homogeneous update rules. You can think of update rules, homogeneous update rules as rules that treat every cell in the same way. And as a consequence of this requirement, homogeneity, so the evolution treats every cell in the same way, you can derive the fact that the graph of causal influences is actually a Cayley graph. So it represents a group, essentially. So the idea is that homogeneity comes with a group structure, a very symmetric structure in which the cells of your array are distributed. So somehow, the evolution dictates some geometry for your array. Okay? So the geometry does not pre-exist the evolution rule. It's the other way around. You look at the way in which cells evolve, and then you infer a geometric structure. So now the question is, can we generalize this? This result is very interesting. It's promising also in view of the question that Lucien was posing at the beginning, because you see, if the geometric relations come from the dynamics, this is a novel approach to a way of encompassing gravitational effects into the quantum description of physical systems, because the way in which we understand gravity nowadays is geometric. So if geometry is an emergent description of the causal relations between the cells of cellular automaton, for example, it might be that in a suitably conceived cellular automaton, this geometry depends on the informational content of the cell. But the problem is that if we go to the general scenario of operational probabilistic theories, we don't have such a thing as a Hilbert space. We only have state spaces or effect spaces, which are the spaces of, for example, in the quantum case, would be the spaces of density matrices or POVMs, the span of the POVMs. We don't have field operators, so only transformations. So the field operator can be thought of as a Krauss operator for a completely positive map. Here we only have completely positive maps. We don't have, in general, a Krauss description of those. And so we cannot have, for example, a notion of a linear automaton. So all the construction that I showed you seems to be based on this notion. And we would like to see if we can recast everything in a way which is free from this underlying mathematical description. So can we generalize it? And will we find the same results, or these are specific of fermionic quantum computation? So now let's start seeing what happens. If we want to construct just a memory array, an infinite memory array in operational probabilistic theories. So in the literature about operational probabilistic theories, you will always find a disclaimer that was done, for example, by John at the beginning of his talk, which is, we will deal with finite dimensional Hilbert spaces. Okay, so now what happens if we put infinitely many of them together? This is usually an infinite dimensional Hilbert space, and to construct this infinite tensor product is a difficult task. It was done by von Neumann, and then his works were elaborated by other mathematicians that came up with the theory of sister algebras, which is a technically complicated theory. So what we will do here is try to grasp the essence of this construction and translate what is possible to translate in the case of operational probabilistic theories. So the first thing to do, at least the first thing that I propose to do, is to construct the space of effects. And why is that? We will discuss in a minute the fact that causality comes to help here, because we can easily make sense of a local effect, which is an effect that occurs on finitely many systems. So this is something which is mathematically well defined within the context of any operational probabilistic theory that we know up to now. We can think of this as being padded with deterministic effects everywhere. So the deterministic effect is unique. There's a unique way of making sense of this object. Okay. This seems easy. However, I have a disclaimer to do. Here, you will see probably the tensor product symbols in many situations. However, this has nothing to do with the tensor product structure, at least not immediately, because we are not considering the case of theories with the local tomography or local discriminability, where just the composition of two systems is described by taking the tensor product of the state spaces of the two systems alone. Here, if we put together two systems, you can have a much larger Hilbert space, much larger state space than just a tensor product of the two. So this is a rather abstract symbol that just says that you're considering the state space of the composite system. And there will be a complicated rule, which is one of the items that make up an operational probabilistic theory, to calculate this space out of the two component spaces. So we don't have a rule to build, in any sense, a mathematical tensor product of all these Hilbert spaces. So we start from these local effects. And what is nice about causality is that if you take two of them, which are localized in two different regions, for example, having this rule of padding the deterministic effect everywhere, you can take also any binary relation between these two effects and generalize it in the case of infinite systems. Like, for example, the sum. If you want to sum two effects, what you do is just enlarging the system on which this effect acts with all these extra systems in the effect B, and vice versa. And this is just taking the parallel composition of the original effect with the deterministic one. And then you have two effects that both act on this whole region, and you know how to sum them. And you can also confront effects with an ordering relation related to the existence of a cone in the space of effects. Any binary relation between effects can be generalized in this case. So you can construct a real vector space. You can take any finite linear combination of these effects with this simple rule. However, this space is not a complete space. It's a Banach space. It's a norm space because it has all the norms that come from the operational probabilistic a theory scenario. So you can define operational norm distances between effects and so on and so forth. I will not dwell on these details here, but you need to define the limits of sequences. So what you do is just the usual construction of taking Cauchy sequences in this space according to the operational norm distance, and then collecting them into a complete Banach space. So you can complete this space and get the so-called quasi-local effect. So any quasi-local effect is an effect that you do on all these systems, and this one can be approximated arbitrarily well by effects that occur only on finitely many systems. Okay, this is the operational idea behind this construction. Okay, now some remarks about this point. Why did we start with effects? I already stressed the role of causality, because it's simple to sum effects localized in different regions thanks to the uniqueness of the deterministic effect that we have to pad, to use to pad the local effects when we sum them. There's another reason. So we will construct the state space as the space of functional on the space of effects. So it's a huge space. We will do a similar construction with states, we construct quasi-local states. This is much more complicated than in the case of effects because you don't have a unique way of padding a local state. But beyond that, not all functionals on the space of quasi-local effects are quasi-local states. So you have a much larger space than the one of quasi-local states. And what are then states? So you take functionals on space of effects, and the proper states of your system are those states that if you measure them with local effects, they just behave like local states. Okay? You have a notion of what is a global state in terms of its local behavior on effect. Okay. So we'll now introduce the quasi-local states, but as I already warned you, this is just a small, very small subspace of the space of global states. So the construction is very similar to the previous one, except that we have to decide somehow arbitrarily the way of padding local states. So we start doing a partition of our set of systems. And this is arbitrary, of course. So you divide your system into finite regions, and then you attribute a background state to each of those regions. And then you start constructing the space of quasi-local state based on this partition B and this choice of background state rho naught by taking all these states that differ from the original, from the background one, only on a finite collection of regions. Okay. Once you do this, you can construct a space, as in the case we did with for effects. And this is the space of local states. And also in this case, you take Cauchy sequences and complete the space, and you get the space of quasi-local states. This depends, of course, on the partition B and on the background state rho naught. Okay? The collection of all these spaces is a subspace of the space of global states. And then you have also the algebra, an important algebra, which is the algebra of quasi-local transformations. So as in the case of effects, you can think of a transformation that is a transformation of this finite number of systems in your operational probabilistic theory. and think of padding it with identities everywhere else. So for example, the action of this transformation on this state is simply this one. It will transform this into another local state in the, acting on it in this way. So it's the identity everywhere apart from the non-trivial part of the transformation, and it will act on the state, the original state sigma here, plus the background state where you have to pad in a suitable way. So we have quasi-local effects, which is the original space, the one which we will use to define cellular automata. We have the notion of quasi-local states and quasi-local transformations. So what is a cellular automaton? It's a map, a linear map, on the space of effects, of quasi-local effects. And we will say that it's admissible every time, when every time you extend your infinite system with an extra system C, well, this transformation will preserve the set of effects. This is an extension of our well-known notion of complete positivity. Okay? So it will preserve the cone of states even if you apply the transformation locally on a composite system. It must be reversible, and the inverse should be admissible too. And finally, if you use this conjugation to transform quasi-local transformations, you want to preserve their quasi-local nature. So this means that we'll see maybe clearer, more clearly in the next slides. The idea is that if you do a local intervention on your system, then the evolution propagates it locally. So your intervention will not affect immediately all the space of your memory cell. Okay, so this seems to be quite a reasonable requirement for a candidate physical law. And these actually are very general. So what characterizes a cellular automaton is not only this, but the requirement of homogeneity that we have to define in the scenario, actually, and locality. Okay. So how do we define these notions? First of all, I need to introduce the notion of a causal influence. What does it mean that, according to your cellular automaton, the content of a cell can causally influence the content of other cells? The idea is the following. Suppose you do a local intervention, which is described by the transformation F on a system G, and then when you conjugate with your cellular automaton, this becomes a local transformation that involves also G prime, okay, non-trivially. So this transformation does not act as the identity on G prime. Then we will say that you have a causal influence from G to G prime, okay, directly. Direct influence. And to see this in a more clear way, you can use this simple identity that exploits the invertibility of the cellular automaton rule and rewrite the diagram in this way. So this definition tells you that if you do something on this system before a step, then if you want to reproduce this effect after the step, you have to involve all the systems that are somehow contained in the causal cone of influence of this system G. Okay. Notice that this relation implies the non-signaling. Okay? So if you, for example, or the signaling relation. So for example, here I showed you a situation where an intervention on this system does not affect this system. What does it mean? Actually, you can prove that if you discard this system, it's like discarding all the things that are not involved and not affecting all the systems that are not affecting this region. So this condition implies the signaling condition for channels, but not the other way around. So, for example, the possibility of changing the probability distribution of outcomes on this system is not required in order to say that you have an influence from here to there. For example, your evolution can just introduce some entanglement of this system with this one, and there will be a causal influence. Even though if this happens, just producing entanglement doesn't mean that you have an influence on the probability distribution of outcomes on this system. So suppose, for example, that you start from two uncorrelated states here, and the evolution prepares a maximally entangled state between these two. Then, of course, the marginal on this system is a maximally chaotic state. And so you don't have a causal signaling. You don't have signaling from this system to the other because this will not affect the outcomes of that system in any way. But since you're producing entanglement, we will say that you have a causal influence. So this notion is definitely stronger than the non-signaling one. Okay. So now we have a binary relation between sites, and we can do the same construction that I showed you in the case of linear fermionic cellular automata. So every time you have a causal influence between one system to the other, it will draw an arrow between those two, and then we will end up with a graph, as I showed you in the case of linear fermionic cellular automata. Okay, so now we have a graph, and we want to define homogeneity. So what does it mean that the rule treats every system in the same way? This is a complicated notion, because we don't have a natural way of defining translation on our memory array, because this symmetry comes from the properties of the evolution relation. So first of all, we have to define what are homologous regions, regions that are indistinguishable according to the evolution dictated by your date rule, by your cellular automata. So suppose you do a signal intervention here and then a test intervention in this region. This is the system G. Then this equality is trivial. But now we will say that this system is homologous to this one if there is a global transformation that allows you to simulate perfectly this experiment with an experiment on this system. So if this is the case, we have no way to tell apart the system F from the system G, because you are doing the same operations on this region and on this region as the same operation you are doing here and there. So this is the same operation done on different systems. And also, this is the same operation done on different systems. But you don't have any way of telling them apart, because it's statistics of outcomes of this test will be the same. Okay? So you will say that these two regions are homologous. And homogeneity is the requirement. Oh, sorry. If this is the case, by the way, taking them as the identity gives you this trivial identity. So this symmetry group is a group that lives invariant the global evolution rule. So homogeneity is the requirement that every two sites are homologous. Every two systems in your memory cell, in your memory array, are homologous. You cannot tell them apart. You don't have a test that you can do on this system and repeat on the other system and say, okay, this behaves differently from that one, so I find a preferential system in my array. This is impossible. However, it's possible to distinguish the role played by two systems with reference to a third system. Okay? If you establish a reference frame, for example, in space, you're able to give different coordinates to a point and to another point. We want to be able to do this. Even though the systems are indistinguishable absolutely, they must be distinguishable with respect to a third system. And so if you take system F and system G, and you make these two pairs with any extra system E, then it will never occur that these two pairs are homologous. Okay? So if I point a laser here from here, or there from here, I see two different things, a spot here or a spot there. If this was not the case, every time I point my laser there, a spot will appear also on the other wall. There's no test that makes me able to distinguish the two walls. Okay? I want to avoid this situation. And so in my definition of homogeneity, I require that the two systems absolutely are homologous, but with respect to a third system are never homologous. You can distinguish their role with respect to a third system. So with this definition, actually, you can recover the same result that I discussed before. So homogeneous cellular automata in operational probabilistic theories always come up with a structure which is that of a Cayley graph. So the memory array is structured in this way. The graph of causal influence relation is a graph that represents a group. It's a very symmetric space. And now let's come to the locality requirement. So locality is the idea that the global evolution can be reduced, can be completely described by a bunch of local evolution rules. So for example, if you want to see what happens to a transformation that is done, to an intervention on your system G, there will be a finite neighborhood that will be affected by your intervention. So when you evolve your system by conjugating with the cellular automaton, only a finite region will be transformed. And then you have a a finite transformation that involves only the resistance and the neighborhood. And you can describe the evolution given by the cellular automaton by the conjugation with this finite transformation. So instead of taking all the global evolution of this system, if you want to see what happens to a local intervention, then you can just cut out this region and then define a transformation on this finite system and evolve your transformation with this finite transformation. And you will have the same result. Okay. So if you want to be able to describe the global evolution in terms of a patch of local region, local transformation that can be applied independently on all the neighborhoods, you have to take care of what happens this is a technical point. You have to take care of what happens when the two neighborhoods intersect. But if they don't intersect, of course, the two transformations commute. You have to take care in this case of intersection, but this is just a technical part. I want to skip this. And what you see is that as a consequence of locality, every vertex in your graph has finitely many arrows. So the neighborhood of every point is finite. Okay, first thing. And the second thing, that you can conclude is that the elementary closed paths on your graph are bounded. So if you have a closed path like this big one, you can see it as a patch of small and elementary closed paths. But the elementary ones are always these four. For example, in this graph, there are four of them. This blue pentagon, the red pentagon, and these two squares. Actually, this is just one square. So these are the three elementary closed paths. And every closed path on this graph can be seen as the patch of some of these elementary ones. Okay. So with this property, you can prove that the graph is quasi-isometric to some smooth Riemannian manifold. So in the class, so you have an equivalence relation between metric spaces, which is quasi-isometry. It's not exactly an isometry. It's an isometry up to constants, some fixed constants. But every metric space comes within a class, equivalence class, of other metric spaces, which are those that are quasi-isometric to the given one. And so once your evolution dictates one specific Cayley graph, then in the class of this Cayley graph, there's essentially a unique smooth Riemannian manifold. So in this way, a local homogeneous cellular automaton isolates a geometric picture of the space where the computation occurs. So you can think of this space as the best way you have to describe geometrically the evolution of the given by your information process.
Yeah, so am I supposed to understand it? Is it, I mean, you get from your Cayley graph, I guess, some notion of distance then? And then,
sure.
You mean by this, by the geometry, that it's like an embedding into a smooth geometry that reproduces distances in terms of geodesics?
It's an embedding. Okay, the idea is the following. First of all, on a Cayley graph, there's a natural notion of a distance, which is this one. You take two points, and you take the shortest path between the two. Okay, so it's naturally given a metric space structure. Now, if you have a quasi-isometric Riemannian manifold, you can think of embedding this graph there, not exactly respecting the distances, but distorting them just by a limited amount. Okay, a uniformly limited amount. So you will not have to dilate distances arbitrarily or contract arbitrarily. Okay? And there's a unique, essentially unique manifold, of course, up to quasi-isometries, but there's a unique Riemannian manifold where you can do that once I give you a Cayley. So let's come to some examples. The examples we started from are fermionic cellular automata, and we started from the case the case where the theory, the underlying operational probabilistic theory we are considering is fermionic theory. And I already told you somehow what is fermionic theory. What you can say about cellular automata in this case is that you can think of them as rules that transform the field operators. So you have a full description of the evolution once you give a function, phi prime, which is a polynomial in the field operators at the previous step. So the evolution is described by these polynomials. So An important result about this automata is the wrapping lemma. The wrapping lemma was proved by Schumacher and Werner for quantum cellular automata. But we reproduced exactly the argument in the case of fermionic cellular automata in this application. So you can generalize this result. And the result says that whenever you have a global rule on a group, on a Cayley graph of a group like Z, okay, the integers, you can take the corresponding local rule, and it will define a good cellular automaton also on any finite group, which has the same cycles of length 4 or less than 4. For example, on Z, you don't have cycles of length 4. So any group that doesn't have cycles of length 4, and with just one generator, would be would support a cellular automaton with the same local rule. So for example, any cyclic group. And the smallest one is Z5. Now I show you the reason why. So the conditions for reversibility of the transform of the evolution are related to the structure of the neighborhoods of points. So for example, this point is a neighborhood which is the one highlighted here in green. And this other point is a neighborhood which is the one highlighted in purple. And they intersect only on this side. Okay? So every time you have another group with the same generator and the same structure of neighborhoods, so the same intersections, the local rule will work fine also on the finite group. And this is the case, for example, for the pentagon, where you see that these two neighborhoods intersect only in one point. If I made this group shorter by one edge, then they would these two neighborhoods would intersect in a further point, and then the neighborhood structures of the of this finite group and the integers would be different. Okay? So this is the reason why you don't have to introduce cycles of length 4 if they were not on the original graph. Okay, having said that, if you find a local rule, a global rule on the integers, it would correspond to a local rule on this pentagon. So if you find all the local rules on the pentagon, you classified all the cellular automata on the integers. And the nice thing about that is that it's much easier to characterize evolution rules on a finite system than on an infinite one. And by the way, there's a result that comes to help here, because it's easy to prove that in order for a transformation to be unitary on a finite set of fermionic modes, it's sufficient that it preserves the anti-commutation relation. So you can look for all the possible cellular automata by looking at all the transformations on these five fermionic modes that preserves the anti-commutation relations. And so I will now review the first result we had in this research project, which is the case that we had when we analyzed linear fermionic cellular automata. So if we started considering cellular automata on graphs that are quasi-isometric to Z to the cube. This is the group that is embeddable essentially in the space, in the physical space, three-dimensional physical space, R to power 3. And these graphs are essentially, you can think of them as Bravais lattices and slight modifications on top of this. So a fermionic cellular automaton with one fermionic mode per each vertex is trivial. Okay. So if you go really for the simplest case, where you only have a local mode at each site, you will have only a trivial evolution, the identity. So the simplest case is the one where you consider two fermionic modes per each site. Okay. In the simplest case, if you impose the reversibility conditions, you see, for example, that among the infinitely many lattices that describe the group Z to the cube, the Cayley graphs of Z to the cube, only one can support a reversible evolution. And it's the so-called body-centered cubic lattice. So this is an astonishing result, I would say. Moreover, there are only essentially two solutions to the unitarity conditions, which means that you don't have many cellular automata with two fermionic modes per site on Cayley graphs of this group. Essentially, you have two of them. And when you look at them from the perspective of states that are rather delocalized, so states that involve plane waves on the graph only with very big wavelengths, so you don't resolve the discrete structure of this graph, then you can describe this evolution by various equations. So locality and homogeneity single out the evolution of a vial field, vial spinal field. And it's I would like to stress this result because we never used the Poincaré covariance. We never used the Lorentz covariance. The Lorentz group comes out of this construction, is not put beforehand. Okay? It's just homogeneity and locality that gives this evolution law. And these are Weyl's equations. And using the Weyl automaton as a building block, you can construct also different evolutions like the Dirac field evolution. And if you consider special cases of entangled states of two excitations on, for the cellular automaton that describes the Weyl field, you will also find Maxwell's equations. So the basic equations of free quantum field theories are there. It's little more than homogeneity and locality and linearity, so linearity of the evolution. Now the question is, can we recover also the interaction between fields, between these fields, interacting theories like QED, QCD, and so on? To do this, you need to study a much more complicated case of nonlinear cellular automata. And so we started considering a very simple one, just to build the appropriate tools. And this is the case of Z, so the integer line. You take the Dirac automaton, the linear one, and you add a kind of gauge transformation, a nonlinear transformation. Before doing the Dirac step, you allow for a misalignment of the local reference frame that does not spoil the homogeneity of the evolution. And there's essentially a unique choice to do this. So what you get is this interaction, this kind of interaction. You see, it's a simple interaction. It's activated when you have two excitations in the same site. So every site has two modes. You can think of, you call them the upper one and the lower one. So if these two are populated, then your state gets a phase. If any of these two is not populated, then nothing happens. This is a very trivial interaction, but it already has an interesting phenomenology. So we did this working collaboration with Alessandro Bisio and Alessandro Tosini, they're two postdocs, and they succeeded in completely analytically diagonalizing this evolution in the sector where two excitations are there. And you can find two bands of continuous spectrum and one bound state. So all these black lines that you see here correspond to the bound states in the case of different values of the coupling constant. But given a value of the coupling constant, you have only one bound state. And moreover, there's an interesting phenomenon here that occurs here because you have this continuous subspace of non-degenerate eigenvalues that becomes completely degenerate here. So you have a space of bound states with when the total momentum of the two particles is zero. And then another result that we had is the following. This is done in collaboration with a PhD student, Leopoldo Poggiali. And it's the classification. Sorry. The classification of nonlinear cellular automata on these two graphs. Okay. So since, as I told you, since the finite graphs are much easier to study than infinite graphs, what we did was to write polynomials of field operators on these two graphs and just impose the preservation of anti-commutation relations. And we ended up finding all the classification of possible nonlinear cellular automata on these two simple graphs. But I remind you that this means that we classified already all the nonlinear cellular automata that you can have on the integers. Okay? This is in the case where you have one fermionic mode per side. So the linear case is excluded, or you only have the trivial evolution, as I mentioned before. But here you don't have, you are considering nonlinear evolutions, and then there are non-trivial solutions. So that's almost all I had to say. Now let me just thank the people I'm collaborating with, Mauro Dariano, of course, and then our senior postdocs, Alessandro Tosini and Alessandro Bisio, to junior postdocs, Nicola Mosco and Marco Erba, and then a PhD student, Leopoldo Poggiali, who doesn't want to be shown in a picture here. So thank him anyway. And this is just a summary of what I told. Thank you.
So you started motivating this by saying that you want to understand the emergence of physical laws, perhaps some algorithm of sorts, right? Can you draw a some parallels between, for example, complexity theory, computational complexity theory, and what kinds of physical laws you can get, and let's say some, if you will, computational dynamics and the dynamics of your physical system, etc.?
Well, thank you for this very inspiring question. We haven't thought about direct connection with complexity theory, but there's one thing I can tell you, that low complexity criterion is what drove us to a certain extent. As I showed you, for example, in the case of... in the case of the Weyl automaton, what we did was to consider the simplest cases. So one fermionic mode per site, trivial evolution. So just do the minimal step of complexity and go to two fermions per site. But this is the most compact local rule that you can think of on this graph. So you can see this as a criterion of keeping the complexity as the Kolmogorov complexity of the rule as small as possible. Even though I wouldn't say that it's a rigorous proof that this is the simplest, that the smallest Kolmogorov complexity algorithm, this would be too far.
All right, so about the idea of emergent geometry, I very much sympathize with this, especially since one of the problems I'm interested in is concerned with these ideas of how we might recover geometry from properties of the dynamics, because if these approaches where you don't assume predefined time at all, for instance, there are observations where we can make that suggest that this is possible. So but in your approach, I wonder, you still assume time, is that correct? There is the automaton somehow.
But the computation occurs into steps, yeah.
Steps.
Essentially, assuming causality from the outset is like assuming time. That it's not restrictive to say that you have time if the theory is causal.
So does this limit to some extent what kinds of geometries or perhaps superpositions of geometries we might imagine occurring in a context of gravity? Because you have a sort of foliation in a way already fixed, and then the freedom that we have in is perhaps the spatial geometry, how it evolves in time, but maybe not fully. What one might imagine might be happening in quantum gravity.
I think that only this is only partially true, because this construction is very general. So you don't use causality to give this definition. Okay. So to define the influence, you don't need causality. So the removal of causality will only complicate the construction of the infinite parallel composition. But I wouldn't say that it forbids you from defining this sort of local rule or homogeneous rule of evolution.
So you think an ultimate theory, if this framework provides us with an ultimate framework, would in some sense admit a foliation with causality?
Well, I'm not saying this. I'm just saying that I don't see this as a limitation. So the fact that you have, for example, this limited causal influence doesn't mean that you can have a foliation. Because cutting the foliation through a graph means that all the probabilities of events everywhere on your graph will depend only on the state in this foliation. And if the theory is not causal, this is not true, because this depends also on the choice of the measurements that you do. It's actually the definition of violation of causality. So I wouldn't say that you will find, for example, emergent differential equations that are with hyperbolic conditions, where you can define Cauchy surfaces where the boundary condition determines all the rest of the system. I'm not saying this. I'm just saying that anyway, you can define a physical law in the same way. That's much less than the second plane.
Yeah, actually maybe touches also a tiny bit on this. But actually a very nice perspective. But so when you restrict this to the classical or quantum case, in which way is this really different than just doing lattice field theory? Because also lattice field theory, I mean, you also have, for instance, I mean, field variables given at some time. And then you have a transfer matrix, which is basically your A that you gave at the very beginning that tells you how to evolve the system in time. And of course, usually when you do lattice field theory, you're given a particular lattice structure that dictates you what this A, this transfer matrix is. But you can also revert this and say, well, now we want to start out with some given data and we want to start defining or allowing for a much more general class of these transfer matrices that you can build up at scratch. And in fact, also in lattice gravity or lattice quantum gravity models, people do this. You can also build up this transfer matrix, for instance, from local moves. So a bit similar to what you're doing, and then you know to compose them together to generate some global transfer matrix. So it seems to me that this is something, I mean, is basically very similar to what you're doing, and so I'm wondering what the differences are here. And then, so there's a couple more things. So in fact, it's even in quantum gravity, one could say that in some sense, at least in the canonical theory, some of this philosophy is also encoded. You have a Hamiltonian that locally generates your discrete, kind of locally evolves your system in time. And then this is a bit like, but here, this time is a bit like you don't necessarily have to interpret it as a physical time. And in that regard, at the end of the day, it's still possible that what comes out of the theory is not necessarily with a well-defined quantum structure, for instance, despite the fact that you start out with well-defined evolution rules. Mm-hmm. Of course, what I understand here is that you like to try to put constraints on this transfer matrix A to get some nice geometry out of it, because for arbitrary A's, probably we'll get some totally random stuff that might not have geometric interpretation. And I guess like this, you get, for instance, here this from the Kayleigh graph and the homogeneity, this something like relativistic symmetry, which is quite nice. But at least in terms of basic ingredients, I think it's already much encoded in the lattice field theory.
Okay, so first of all, the first question, I'm not an expert in lattice field theories, but the few ones that I know use the notion of the action. So define the action on the lattice. When you do this, you might end up with a theory which makes sense in the limit, but it's not unitary. As you can see from this example, unitarity constrains a lot your lattice. So for example, the typical lattice that people would use, the cubic one, wouldn't support a unitary evolution. Okay. So this is an important thing to take into account, because here we don't want to go to the limit. This structure is just our array, and the space that emerges is something is a coarse-grained description of the dynamics on the system. But we won't take the limit for lattice step going to zero, because there's no notion of space in which this lattice lives. Okay? Space is something which is built on top of events. The first point. And related to this, for example, the interpretation of the computational step as a time step comes from this equation. So once you get the dynamics of the Weyl equation, you can think of the step as the evolution in time, because this time derivative is exactly what appears in your physical law. But if you don't end up with a physical law that is interpreted in terms of already known physics, then there's no way, there's no reason why you should interpret this computational step as the physical time. And this is the second part of the question. And finally, what was the other? The last question you asked was
two questions and just a comment on indefinite quantum structures, but that was not really the question.
Sorry. Let me say one other thing. Yeah. You said that we constrain a lot the transfer matrices, for example, by homogeneity. But homogeneity is dictated by a consideration of how physical laws work. At least in the mind of a physicist, if you understand a physical law, this will hold everywhere in space. So there's no reason why a physical law should act differently on systems here and on a faraway galaxy. So homogeneity, I would say, is a very natural requirement for a computation which is candidate to simulate a physical law. But I wouldn't say that it's just put there in order to obtain a very symmetric structure, because this is a kind of symmetry which we look for in a physical law.
No, so that was not a critique. It's maybe nice to impose some sort of operation or constraints on, you know, reducing the possibilities of this transfer matrix sets, because in general you could get whatever you want, or almost.
Yeah.
But then actually another comment on, sorry, because in Lattice field theory you can actually get local evolution moves that are unitary, so in also the quantum theory. It's, so in that sense I think it would be actually pretty similar to what you have. So I think instructions are also there.
I think we should go to lunch now. Just got to step back up now a little bit.